BBC Sounds. Music, radio, podcasts.
Hello, I'm Tom Heap, and this is Costing the Earth from BBC Radio 4.
People on Caribbean islands in the path of Hurricane Maria are taking shelter as the second powerful storm in a fortnight approaches.
A century ago, as many as 10 million African elephants roamed the continent. Now, growing scientific evidence that toxins in the air are more damaging to our health than previously.
Devastating tornadoes have ripped through Alabama in the United States, killing at least...
Saving planet Earth. Scientists warn the way we treat our soil is fueling climate change.
Swifts, sparrows and bluebells. How the loss of pollinators... Insects.
Wildfires burning out of control in California have killed at least...
India's praise for its evacuation of a million people. But
the world's top scientists say dramatic action is needed now to save the world from climate catastrophe.
Rising global temperatures spell disaster.
These are the final moments of the universe.
I'm Verity Sharp. I'm a music broadcaster and also someone who's had a deep love of the natural world for all of my life. But with all these reports coming thick and fast about ecosystem collapse, I found myself feeling more and more anxious. Anxious about what to do personally, about what we're doing nationally, and the effects that this is already having globally. My concerns, the fact that it's affecting my sleep and colouring my daily life, means that I may have what's being called eco-anxiety, and I'm sure I'm not alone in feeling it. Alice Brown is a vivacious, intelligent, passionate young woman, and sitting cross-legged on her sofa in her flat in Bristol, she told me about the time that she went to get a cup of coffee with her dad and burst into tears.
And I went to a work meeting with him, we had a coffee beforehand. The woman handed us disposable cups without me even getting a chance to say we were drinking in, and it seems like such a minor thing, but everything ripped open. I bawled my eyes out. I was just blubbing away, and he said, "We'll get there, you know, it'll save the world." "No, Dad, you don't understand what needs to happen." He went away, and honestly, by the end of the weekend, he called me and he said, "I understand now," and I'd go as far as to be willing to go to jail for this.
Alice is one of a growing number of young people who've decided not to have children because they fear the future is too unsafe. She's a spokesperson for Birth Strike, and I asked her if she joined the group to make a political statement.
To me personally, I see it more as it's almost like a support group, really. It's hard to, you know, go out and just engage with people about normal things, whatever that is.
And there is this term eco-anxiety, which frankly doesn't really seem to cover it in a way, because anxiety, to be anxious, is quite a normal thing, isn't it? But do you recognise eco-anxiety in all your, you know, sort of fellow activists and even actually the world at large?
It's almost the norm now to talk about this level of hopelessness. I, over the last 6 months, have cried every single day. And when I started to tell people that, that's the same for them.
What were you thinking about your personal life?
In what sense?
Were you thinking that you would have children, get married, do all of that? What was your view of all of that when you were younger?
So I met my partner that I have now about 4 or 5 years ago now, and you know, we both wanted to do a lot of travelling. And yeah, of course, you know, have a family. But everything to me just looks so toxic in the world. What is that going to look like, you know, when it comes to my child being a bit older? Seriously, what is that going to look like? We've already proven that we're not heeding these insane warnings, you know, about the collapse of nature, the collapse of ecosystems. Environmental breakdown isn't something that's coming. It's here already. We're losing 200 species a day. It's not something that's coming in the future. I really don't have trust or faith in the people that, you know, have the power to control that situation, that there will be a safe world for me to have a family. So
I have so much empathy for what Alice is saying, but what does eco-anxiety, or indeed anxiety, mean to a mental health professional?
My name is Daniel Morn. I am the Associate Registrar for the Royal College of Psychiatrists. The fundamental aspects of anxiety are avoidance of stressful situations and autonomic arousal. What does that mean? It's the heart beating faster, it's the breathing faster, sweaty palms, feeling a sense of panic or alarm. There are lots of different types of anxiety disorders. So we would separate out, for instance, generalised anxiety disorder from a phobia, from a post-traumatic stress disorder, from an obsessive-compulsive disorder.
So does the Royal College of Psychiatrists recognise eco-anxiety as a specific condition?
We use the WHO, that's the World Health Organization's criteria of illness. It's called the ICD-10, and that does not include eco-anxiety. I think we really need to tease out the difference between worried well and anxiety disorders. People can be incredibly worried, but they're still functional. They're still able to help themselves. And I think it's really important that we don't impose a model of illness necessarily.
Would you accept that it's increasingly becoming something that we should be preparing for?
I think as our awareness grows, yes, I can see that it might lead more people into experiencing anxiety, and that might tip over into an anxiety disorder.
So how would you know when they tip over into what would be a clinical disorder?
I think there's two ways that I find really useful. So one is about functionality. Can you concentrate, or are you just thinking about climate catastrophe? Can you actually work? Are you able to sleep and eat? These basic things, what's your functioning like? The other thing is, can you help yourself? So people get low mood all the time, people get anxious all the time, but we know we can go for a run, we can go outside into nature, we can do things that are good for ourselves, we manage our mind. But some people, their experience is such that actually, whatever they're doing, they're employing all of their tactics to help themselves and it just isn't working. The anxiety is getting worse. That would be a point where I'd say, we need to help you here. But I don't think I've noticed an increase in morbidity or illness rates around specifically climate anxiety as yet.
But other mental health practitioners have noticed an increase. Caroline Hickman is a fellow at the University of Bath and a psychotherapist with the Climate Psychology Alliance. From where she's standing, eco-anxiety is on the rise.
I'm getting referrals on a daily basis from people who are feeling the anxiety and the terror is making it hard for them to function. And it's not just about anxiety, it's a whole mix of feelings which people are finding really difficult to cope with. It's grief, it's rage, it's despair, it's loss, it's guilt, it's shame. I've been talking with women who are fantasising about killing their children. This is a sort of apocalyptic thinking. This is it taking it forward in the next 10 years. What if? What if there are food riots here? What if there is not enough water to go around? What am I going to do? How am I going to look after my children? And that's touching an ordinary human anxiety of vulnerability. We are not in control. And that's one of the roots of anxiety for all of us. But they're imagining what they will do to take care of their children.
Today I couldn't leave my bed because I felt so anxious. I watched 3 hours in a row of Carl Sagan's Cosmos, and I guess it helps a little bit to put things in perspective and think about how the universe is so complex and infinite.
It consumes every thought in that way where you're sort of sitting on a bus and like surrounded by other people and you're like, how are you guys not panicking?
Faith Elliott is a singer-songwriter and artist.
And I would just read about it obsessively and not be able to sleep. And I guess I thought a lot about how to make art that would change people's minds or stir them into doing more about the environment. But I don't think I made very much good art around that time. You can't do anything about this stuff if you can't sleep and if you're panicking and if you have really terrible anxiety.
Fungus is tall as skyscrapers and colour changing squares.
George Marshall is the director of Climate Outreach, an organisation specialising in climate communication. He's also the author of Don't Even Think About It, which examines the psychological mechanisms of denial to explain why climate change so often fails to connect with people.
Most people, if they're asked about climate change, will say, yeah, that's a big problem. If you delve a little deeper, you'll find that they're saying, yeah, that's a huge problem for the future or future generations or different species or animals or polar bears or things a long way away. And that's an active, socially constructed narrative. They're creating what we would call a psychological distance. Or more commonly also, people distance it by actually not talking about it at all. Now, hopefully that's changing a bit now, but the tendency has been for people to avoid the subject altogether and to deliberately shut down the conversation when it emerges.
Which is why I guess we aren't all suffering from eco-anxiety. There's also something called cognitive dissonance, the discomfort that occurs when one's ideas, beliefs, or behaviours are contradictory. Here's Tim Jones, a teacher from Sheffield.
I felt that I was doing a job that's really important, but I wasn't talking about what's important. I was trying to teach kids how to succeed within a system that's killing us. And that led to a kind of disconnect between my feelings and my actions. And because climate change and ecological breakdown are such massive problems, it does seem like there's really not a lot that you can do about it. And the more you think about it, the more you realise how massive the challenge is, so the more you feel disconnected from reality, from truth. So you have to escape from reality and bury your feelings and think other thoughts and do other things. And that is profoundly unhealthy.
Butterflies wake up at 10 o'clock, they go to sleep at 4 p.m., you're in this gorgeous habitat, and I just fell in love with it, and I thought, I can do this for a living? Okay.
Professor Camille Parmesan is a climate change biologist who works on reports for the IPCC, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change.
I, you know, went down to Mexico, and that was when this first really hit me. And it's like, oh, the habitat was beautiful, fields of flowers. And I'd go there and I'd say, oh, yes, I can see all the host plants. The butterflies should be here. And there was nothing. And site after site of recording these extinctions and spending days, you know, censusing all the plants I could in the site, sometimes going back the next year to make sure, you know, are they really all extinct? And in the end, 80% of those sites were extinct, even though the habitat was still beautiful. As a scientist, it's thrilling for me to see the policy process taking in the science very rapidly, understanding it, and translating that into these enormous policy documents. But the action is just not matching what the policy agreements are saying.
And you've described yourself in recent years as having professional depression, so presumably brought on by exactly this. It's all falling on deaf ears.
Yes. I really was saying to my husband, you know, I give up. I altered my research career to actually address the questions policymakers are interested in. What policymakers wanted were these big meta-analyses, these, you know, big modeling exercises, which got me into this whole realm of staring at computer screens, really not what I personally get the most enjoyment and satisfaction out of. So I'm altering my research career to try to tend to the needs of the policy community and society. And you come up with these really powerful results, and you get them published in the top journals, and yet no action is taken, or very little action is taken.
So what about the emotional impact of witnessing firsthand as you are? I mean, your job is to just present information in quite a cold way, really, to policymakers. But you're having to deal with the emotional knowledge that you know, you've seen it. And yet you can't communicate the emotion of that. Does that have an impact on you personally?
I do feel like, you know, I have two different, well, it's not that I'm two different people, but I go into a professional mode, and the professional mode is, you know, what are the facts? What's happening? How can I summarize this simply so that you understand? But of course, there is an emotional side, and I try to keep that separate from the professional side. But I have to admit, it's very depressing. What's really been depressing is actually going to tropical coral reefs, going back to a site I was at 10 years ago that was teeming with life, beautiful blues and purples and reds of the corals, and of course these brightly colored tropical fish everywhere. And going back, seeing the corals white, or even worse, sort of brown, covered with an algal scum, because they died during a bleaching event and haven't recovered. That kind of more permanent flip is quite depressing to see. And I'm going to be honest, when I vacation, I make sure I'm going somewhere that's still healthy in terms of biodiversity, because I don't want a vacation somewhere where I'm just going to be depressed and looking at dead corals or looking at a tropical forest that's gradually dying because of you know, increasing drought conditions. So as a professional person, I'll visit those places to document what's happening. As an individual, I want a holiday somewhere that has gorgeous, beautiful biodiversity, and that's getting harder and harder.
Jem Bendel is Professor of Sustainability at the University of Cumbria.
Yeah, the first time I began to doubt that we could stop disruptive climate change was after I became a professor and I gave my inaugural speech, and then I came down with the flu. Just for 3 days with a fever in bed, I started looking at some of the latest climate science I hadn't looked at for years, and it started to look really worrying. And at that moment, that was about 4 years ago, that I had my first moments of despair. But I kind of put them away, and I just thought the implication of that is just to be bolder with what I was already doing.
Last July, Jem Bendel wrote a paper called Deep Adaptation, A Map for Navigating Climate Tragedy, a paper I have to admit I was dreading reading. The abstract says the purpose of this conceptual paper is to provide readers with an opportunity to reassess their work and life in the face of an inevitable near-term social collapse. It's gone viral, with the PDF being downloaded over 400,000 times. Many of the people we spoke to while making this programme had read it.
It really doesn't look like we can cut carbon in time to make much of a difference now. Not that we shouldn't try, but I don't think it's going to work. And so that's ended up with me doing the deep adaptation paper. Mm. But it was a bit of a goodbye to my sector. I didn't expect it to go viral and have the impact it's had, which is, I think, not a reflection of the paper. What it is it's a reflection of that I was helping people to connect with what they already knew, actually have a way of talking about their anxiety that they have about where we're at with climate and how fast things are changing.
So in your paper, you talk about near-term societal collapse, which some people might think is actually not helpful because it will just instill panic. What would you say in response?
I understand people who think that collapse is it's a very emotive term and perhaps not that specific. I define it as an uneven ending in our normal means of sustenance, shelter, security, pleasure, meaning and identity. So it is a very general term, but I used it to emphasise that this isn't just like a financial crisis. This means something significant is going to change in our way of life, and that's because of how climate's going to impact on, particularly on the big breadbaskets of the world. We saw in the summer of 2018 the disruption to agricultural production across the Western Hemisphere. That's the new normal. We're going to see more of that and worse. Once people are going hungry in the West, normal life is going to break apart. So we need to really think about how we cope with that. But I'm hoping that by talking about what may now be coming down the road, we can begin to prepare. And that means preparing not just practically through sort of irrigated potato farms, but also psychologically, so that we don't make matters worse through our panic reactions.
Do you feel any kind of regret that, you know, you've opened up those, like in a way you're sort of making people face this sense of despair?
I wrote the paper to speak to people in my profession, my sector, so sustainable business, and I felt that many of them, like me, were seeing all the latest bad news and were just pushing it away. And so they're all going to work in environmental NGOs or as corporate responsibility managers in companies, and they were doing useful work, but they had a role really, and I was inviting them to wake up and change. So I didn't really think about who else would would be affected by it. So looking back at it now, no, I don't regret it. There are many people struggling with many difficult emotions, either reading my work or reading everything else that's coming out. I mean, when it came out in July, it was unusual, but the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change in October last year has said very similar things. So these difficult emotions are inevitable. And so it's how we share this information. It's not whether we should or not, we should, but how do we support each other, knowing that this is going to be really tough to hear? And so that's why I think it's really important that not only does the psychotherapy profession and counselling and coaching professions get better at looking at climate anxiety or climate trauma, but also I think we need to look at ways that we can democratise access to psychotherapeutic support, get it off the couch and make it more normal in society and help each other have conversations about difficult emotions.
This is a lot to take in, I know, and there's something about Jem's calm tone of voice that makes it all the more unnerving. It is so hard to hear. But as more and more people really start absorbing all this, how are mental health services, which are already stretched to breaking point, going to be able to support us? Dr. Daniel Morn again.
One of the things that we're doing is we're educating. We're trying to get it into the curriculum. We already have online teaching about this issue. There are health impacts from climate change, so we need to be concerned. And we need to be prepared to adapt services. I think one of the most alarming things about the current situation is that people are really talking about this now in a very meaningful, powerful, galvanising way. And things don't seem to be changing. And we know that in depression, certainly, learned helplessness can be very disabling. I would hope that if the government makes some changes, if we as a society can start responding in a positive way to this potential catastrophe, then that might help alleviate this learned helplessness. Yes, if nothing changes, anxiety might increase. But if we're seeing changes, if we can plug into social movements, if we can do something about it, that's a societal treatment that we can really use.
Dr. Daniel Morn's idea of getting this subject into the curriculum seems imperative. It's lacking at the moment, and our teacher Tim Jones has decided to leave the profession and become a full-time activist with Extinction Rebellion.
I went to an NVDA training, which is non-violent direct action training, learnt how to be arrested, and the following week was the first big action that we did, which is when we blockaded the five bridges in central London. And this weight lifted off me, and it was just a beautiful moment. I saw 5,000 people who didn't know what they were doing. They had no idea what they were doing, but you could see it in their faces as they stood on the sides of the bridges, and I was on Blackfriars Bridge, and there were loads of police, and I thought they're just going to clean us up and chuck us in the river or whatever, and we were all waiting and waiting, and then suddenly somebody ran out and said, now, walk into the road. So we all walked into the road, and it was nothing, you know. We blocked the traffic for a few hours. We didn't really do anything. No one really noticed. It wasn't in any of the papers, but I suddenly felt like I had done something. I'd in a very minor way, I'd stood in a road for a bit and then moved when I was told to move. But it felt like I'd done something, and it just makes sense. The only thing that matters is how we act with the time that we've got. Of course we're going to be depressed if there is this disconnect between what we feel and what we do. And so, yeah, now I feel, even though I am constantly in it, I'm still going through a process of grief at the loss of what has been and still is just a profoundly beautiful natural world that's full of these miracles of nature. Species going extinct by the hundreds every day through our want of cheap holidays and hamburgers. But I'm doing better in myself because I feel now that I'm doing something real that may or may not have an effect, but it feels to me like there's a better chance of something changing with me doing what I'm doing than me not doing what I'm doing. And it's as simple as that.
Action certainly does help. But I have to say, the decision to make this programme wasn't perhaps the wisest of moves. And on top of that, there's always the guilt. The guilt about indulging in this first world problem of mere anxiety, while around the world, communities are having to deal with the actual reality of climate breakdown. A week after recording the interview with psychotherapist Caroline Hickman, I decided to see her again. Caroline, I've made this programme about eco-anxiety and spoken to a lot of people and heard a lot of very raw emotions from people. And to be honest, I'm actually feeling very anxious myself and actually quite kind of sick. And I wouldn't say I'm not sleeping, but I'm fearful that that's going to be the norm from now on. But now, yeah, I've turned the stone over.
No, I understand that. So you're talking about trying to bring together two worlds. You cannot honestly expect me to, on the one hand, think about what to cook for tea tonight, and on the other hand, think about the end of the world. You can't immerse yourself in that world fully and survive all the time. You have to keep a foot in the what should we have for tea tonight world. Mm. And whatever emotional responses you're having are right. And we need to feel the despair and feel the hope at the same time. And in the middle of that, there is a way forwards. It's not all bad. And it's not all going to be wonderful either. We have to hold the tension between the two. You should not be facing this on your own. You really need to connect with community, any community. So find your pack. Find your clan and join with them so you're not on your own. And that is part of the solution. There are carbon conversations going on. There are earth protectors groups. There's parent groups. There's climate cafes. So act on all of that. Think about where you're banking. Look for ethical investments. Look for ethical farming. But those are all things we can be doing, and all of that will reduce that anxiety.
So if you're feeling anxious about climate breakdown, good. Put it to positive use. All efforts are needed and welcome in this biggest ever challenge. So, what am I going to cook for tea tonight?